Okay, so Happy New Year, everyone. A bad topic probably to start out with, but probably one that's very front and center on everybody's mind. I don't know if you got my last email this morning, but the snowpack throughout the whole state does not look very promising. But like I said, I'm trying to be optimistic, so I'm hoping for those late spring, really wet snows. Tonight we have Don Day. He's a meteorologist and he's been doing this for 30 years. And he and his crew have been broadcasting the weather to over 70 radio stations. So I think he's probably pretty knowledgeable on this topic. And Don, I will let you introduce yourself more appropriately. So take it away.
Sure, thank you. Hello, everybody. Good to see everyone this evening, or going to be talking and interacting with you as we go along. I'm a little bit of a different animal. I'm what's called a private meteorologist, which means that people actually pay me to be wrong occasionally, but I have to be right more than I'm wrong to be able to survive. So I do a variety of things. Holly had mentioned the broadcast side of things. I've been doing over 32 years on radio stations across Wyoming, Colorado, and Nebraska. Earlier in my career, I did do some stations in eastern Montana. I also do a lot of high altitude research, stratospheric research, and some high elevation aviation projects. I have a niche in terms of the stratospheric weather. So I do a little bit of everything, but everything I do is centered around the Western United States. And so I've learned a lot through the School of Hard Knocks in terms of understanding weather patterns in the Western United States. And I'm just south of you guys. I'm down here in Cheyenne, Wyoming. And this is where I've been doing this business since the start. The Intermountain West and the Western High Plains is basically my region of weather forecasting. So, what I want to do to start things off is I want to spend a little bit of time going over some basics. Let me go ahead to share screen here. Of a lot of what drives our weather patterns in the Western United States. And I'm going to spend a good amount of time talking about the Pacific Ocean because we live and die precipitation-wise based on what the Pacific Ocean is going to do. If the Pacific Ocean decides to change its configuration, we have a response with our weather and our climate in the Northern Rockies. If you were to basically capture every raindrop and snowflake that falls in Montana, more than 9 out of 10 are going to come out of the Pacific. We really don't have a lot of opportunities. Sometimes we do to get moisture from the plains to our east or from our south, but that happens once or twice a year. So we spend a lot of time with the Pacific. And I am going to spend a little bit of time here going over just a refresher of El Niños and La Niñas because it'll play a really big part in our discussion about what's happened, where we are now, and where we're going. So what I'm showing you here is the square boxes are showing you where we track sea surface temperatures. So when I talk about sea surface, I am talking about the first several inches of water. And this is really important right along the equator. Now, why is this really important? Why do changes of only a half a degree or two of centigrade of these sea surface temperatures, when they change, how could that change our weather so much? And when you look at that, look at the equator. We're talking east of Australia all the way to South America. How in the world could this impact the weather in Montana when it's so far away? You'd be surprised. The Pacific Ocean is the biggest body of water. It's the largest object on Earth. And that stretch of water that goes from South America to past Australia is the largest body of warm tropical water in the whole world. So think of the subtropical, the equator of the Pacific Ocean as being a battery. Think of it as like an engine. The more efficient that engine is, the more weather it's going to produce for Western North America. More weather means more rain, more snow. The less efficient it's going to be, the less we're going to have in terms of rain and snow. And that efficiency is really based on what the sea surface temperatures are doing. So when we have an El Nino, like what we're doing right now, you have warmer water near the equator, you get more water vapor and energy put into the air that is ending up upstream that then comes into Western North America. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean, as we're experiencing right now, wet conditions immediately, but it does tend to be a signal that's more wet for the Western United States. But a lot of that is tending to be further south, California, the Great Basin, the desert Southwest, the Central Rockies. La Nina is the opposite. When the water's colder, there's less water vapor in the air, less energy. So the El Nino is when your engine is running, that battery is fully charged in the Pacific. La Nina is when it's not running as efficiently and it's not producing as much water vapor in the air. The best analogy I can give you is El Nino is like a hot shower. When you go turn on your shower and you get it hot, all your mirrors and your windows are going to steam up, because that water vapor is leaving the hot water and going into the air. If you had a cold shower, a La Nina, you're not going to steam up your windows. Now, that's a very crude analogy, but that's basically what is happening. And then when you have the whole scale of the Pacific Ocean, this really affects the weather in Western North America, as well as Central and South America. They both alter jet stream precipitation patterns, as we're experiencing right now. We'll talk a little bit about that. And then when we have neither, we call it La Nada, or basically a neutral phase. And these neutral phases tend to happen in between these La Nina and El Nino cycles. It should be said that these cycles have been going on for as far as we know. And it also should be said, and a lot of people don't realize this, we really didn't even know what a La Nina or an El Nino was until the 80s and early 90s. So we're really in the infancy of trying to understand the dynamics of the Pacific Ocean and the sea surface temperature changes and how they affect our weather and climate. It was really, they knew things were changing in the Pacific with water temperature changes for a long time, but the connections to the overall climate of the Western United States really has just been put together in the last couple of decades. There's other variables too. There's other things that are going on that are going to affect the seasonality of our weather patterns. I won't go too far into these. The QBO is a near equator stratospheric event that does play a factor in our winter right now. That's one reason why we had that polar outbreak earlier this winter, and probably we'll have another one before the winter is done. So the stratosphere plays a role, solar plays a role, volcanics play a role as well. So it's not just as simple as what the Pacific is doing, but the overall major weather driver of our weather and climate in Western North America is the Pacific. There's other things involved, but the Pacific is the overall general, so to speak, of how things go. So for Montana, now this is one thing that's really tricky with La Nina and El Nino, is Montana, Southern Alberta, Saskatchewan, Washington and Oregon, and the panhandle of Idaho. The signals are not as strong with La Nina and El Nino patterns as areas further south. And when I say signals, it means when we have a strong El Nino, we know for close to certainty that California is going to be very wet, as well as parts of the Central and Southern Rockies and the Southeastern United States. But as you go further north, the signals weaken. And the same goes with La Nina. You can have both positive and negative impacts with La Nina and El Nino, and each episode's a little bit different. Each La Nina and El Nino is going to be of a different magnitude. They're never exactly the same. But there's a quote that I think we can attribute to Mark Twain, is that history doesn't necessarily repeat itself, but it rhymes. That's what the weather does. It doesn't necessarily repeat itself exactly, but we do see a rhythm to these cold and warm episodes in the Pacific. So we can deduce general patterns and what we can expect overall, not with a lot of resolution, but we can get an idea once we start to putting climatology together and see what we've had in previous La Nina and El Nino episodes to try to find a pattern. I think The biggest problems that the Western United States have is actually La Nina. And we really experienced this here over the last few years, especially when you have a cold Pacific that's more than 2 years in running. The last La Nina we had was a 3-year La Nina, and the Western United States was embedded in drought. So think of the cold shower analogy. We had a cold shower for 3 years. We had that engine in the Pacific running weaker. And then last year, right after the first couple of weeks of January of 2023, La Nina faded away and we transitioned to where we are now with an El Nino. Transition years from one to another actually can bring wet weather to the Western United States. And boy, that was certainly the case in California, Utah, with the record snows they had to our south last year. So Montana is a bit of a sticky wicket because you cannot, with a high degree of certainty, say that El Nino will bring us exactly this or La Nina will bring us exactly this. They tend to be a little bit of a different flavor for the Northern Rockies and the Northern Plains and Southern Canada. However, as we've been experiencing for most of the winter so far, the robust El Nino certainly has led to the minus the Arctic outbreak we had. It's been warmer than average, as we'll see here across the region. Also, I forgot to say this at the beginning. If you do have a question, I don't mind you stopping me as we go along here. Feel free to go on and ask a question if you do have one. Okay, the Pacific and changes in sea surface temperature anomalies. What I'm showing you here is a graph that goes all the way back to 1854 to present. And what you notice here is the red indicates when the overall Pacific basin is warmer, and the blue represents when the Pacific basin is colder. And what you can really see here is if you were to connect all of these lines, you would see that the pattern is a bit of a sine wave. We have warm periods, cold periods, and they fluctuate back and forth. Now, I mentioned to you that the colder Pacific tends to be a drought signature because of the fact that we just have less water going into the air off the Pacific in the Western North America. And you can go back and look at these graphs, and you can find every severe Western drought is going to coincide with the blue more than the red when the Pacific is colder. And if we were to focus in a little bit closer, this is a pattern that people find very interesting in the Western United States. So let's look at the cold and warm cycles, the El Nino and La Nina cycles, going back to 1979. What we had between 1979 and 1998, we had several more warm periods, many more El Nino cycles than La Nina cycles. The dashed line here basically shows a pattern shift in the Pacific. The Pacific went from a warmer mode, a positive Pacific decadal oscillation, to a negative one after the super El Nino of 1998. And if you go back and look at precipitation patterns in the Western United States, Southwest Canada, all the way down into Mexico, you will find that from the late 70s to the late 90s, there were episodes of drought. However, the episodes of drought since 1998 to present have been much more frequent. And you can see the multi-year La Nina that we just went through right here in all the blue. This red is where we are now. So you can see the drought from 21 to 22 to early 23. You can see the dry period that we had right here. You can see the very dry period that we had in 2011 and 2012. And then we had that other dry period. And then the late 90s and the early 2000s. Some of you might recognize some of these drought periods. And it's not because the Pacific's warmer, it's because the Pacific overall was colder during these time frames. It seems a little counterintuitive, but that's actually how things end up. So if we were to look at just an idealized pattern of how the jet streams tend to behave, this is very idealized. But on the right, La Nina winters tend to bring a stronger jet stream from the Gulf of Alaska through Western Canada, taking a dip into the Great Lakes. So the Pacific Northwest, the Northern Plains, parts of the Northern Rockies tend to be colder, while California, a lot of the Central and Southern Rockies and the South tend to be drier. And that's why if you put 2 or 3 years of these in a row, is why a lot of the West tends to be drier. On the left is the idealized El Nino. And a lot of this is exactly what's happened so far. The warmer than normal conditions in Canada, where we're at here, across the Northern Plains, cooler and wetter conditions tend to go from California across the South. So we're definitely seeing this right now. And this is one reason why snowpack has started off so poorly. While overall, we've been warmer than normal on the whole so far this winter season. So what you want to do right now in terms of making a long-range forecast is this El Nino going to stay? Is it going to be as strong as it is now? Is it going to strengthen? Is it going to stay through winter and spring and summer? What's going to happen with it? And that's going to really lead to our forecast here as we go into this next season. So just to review, if we go back and look at the La Nina, look between South America and Australia here, you see the green and the blue. There's your La Nina that we had. That's in January of 2021. That's where we were in 2022. And that's where we were in January of 2023. So after this graphic right here, it really changed and the La Nina faded and went away very quickly. And if you look at the drought monitors during those cold phases in the Pacific, so in May of 21, you can see a lot of the Northern Plains, a lot of the West had very dry conditions, drought over the entire West. May of 2022, same situation, really not much difference. And if you look, the Pacific wasn't changing, therefore the drought conditions weren't changing. But then as we got into late last fall, we really started to see the El Nino take shape. And there you can see the warmer water right there. And then this is the drought monitor in May of this year. So still some dry areas, but much, much less drought than we had in May of 2022. And this is where we are as of last week's drought monitor update. Then, as you guys know, up here, this is expanding across Montana. We have better conditions here in the Midwest, but you can see that California, a lot of the Pacific Northwest is still in a bonus from all that heavy precipitation last winter. So there's a correlation is what I'm showing you here in terms of the amount of acreage in terms of drought. You're just going to have a lot more drought over a lot more area in these La Nina cycles compared to El Nino. Now that may not be comforting you right now based on fact on how warm and dry it's been with El Nino so far. And there was a mention of the snowpack. This was the snowpack January 8th. Now, we did have, this was right before the Arctic outbreak when we started to see things change. Now, since the Arctic outbreak, as of today, snowpacks across Montana still very poor. We've got red and we've got orange and we got yellows. We want to see green or blue, but I want to show you something. Take a look at Colorado, Utah, Oregon, Northern Nevada here, eastern areas of Idaho. Look what happened to those areas before the Arctic outbreak and then what happened afterwards. You see how these are improving? Now, those are very far south from us, but this is a good sign. And I'll show you why here in a minute. Because what this is showing us is the Pacific is starting to throw more our way. In fact, we may see some of this Pacific moisture get into Montana this weekend and into early next week to help things out a little bit. So we've got a long way to go. These are very big deficits. And honestly, I don't know if we're going to be able to get ourselves up to 100% in all the drainages of Montana with such a slow start, but the higher water content snow does come at the back end of the season, not the front end of the season. And there's just the last 90 days with temperature. This doesn't mean Canada is real warm, but you can see the orange and the red that for the last 90 days, the coldest temperatures relative to the 30-year average have been more across the central and southern U.S., warmer than average across the north. And precipitation for the last 90 days, and I'll zoom into Montana here in a second, but I want to show you this increased precipitation in the southern plains, Texas, along the Gulf Coast in the east. This is classic El Nino right here. This is exactly what you would expect. You also expect in El Nino the precipitation to really increase here, and it will. Boy, the next couple of weeks will be very wet, making headlines in the far west here over the next couple of weeks. So if we were to zoom into Montana the last 90 days, this should look familiar to you, with a few exceptions where it's green, which means the anomaly slightly above average, but just barely. But you can see all the red from the Yellowstone Plateau through the Bitterroot, through all of central and northern Idaho and everywhere else. So looking pretty bleak. So what's going to make this change? Is there reason to be optimistic? And the answer is going to be yes. I'll show you that here in a minute. So this is where we are right now with the El Nino. This is the latest prediction. Now there's a lot of squiggly lines here, but what I want you to pay attention to is the green line, which is an average of all these statistical and dynamic weather models that are trying to predict the sea surface temperature anomalies out in that equator area of the Pacific. And this is where we are right now. Notice the green line's going down rather rapidly. So basically, El Niño's reached its peak. It's reaching its peak right now. So it's also going to be causing its biggest impacts here in the coming weeks. Hence, what's going to be happening in California and a lot of the West. The next couple of weeks, we're going to see precipitation increase quite a bit, but it is weakening. So we're not going to see the level of the intensity of El Niño as strong for the rest of the winter and spring as we have seen since November and December and through the month of January. So you can see it got pretty strong, but it crosses the 0.5 threshold. Once it gets past that 0.5 threshold of a temperature anomaly, you're no longer in El Nino status. You're in that La Niña. You're in that neutral phase. And you can see this in terms of the projections of what's going to happen. We're going to see El Nino fade really rapidly. It's really going to fade really quickly by April and May. It's going to hold on into a good part of February. But the blue bars actually are predicting the possibility by fall, maybe, of a La Niña. So this El Nino is a one-hit wonder. And if you were to look at the forecast of sea surface temperature anomalies, I want you to pay attention right here. The first slide is February. The last slide is July. So you can see the warm waters are fading and they start to get colder again. So what's making it so warm and dry in the Northern Rockies of Canada and Montana and the Dakotas, the mechanism responsible for a lot of that so far is going away. It's going to be weakening. And a weaker El Nino is more beneficial for precipitation for us than a strong El Nino. So we're looking at the right pattern for Montana to get more wet. Will it be enough for us to catch up? We're just going to have to wait and see. But I just drew some squiggly lines here to show you visually what I'm thinking as the El Nino changes. This is going to be the main jet stream. This will be a real good example of what's happening this weekend and early next week. But there's going to be a storm so strong over Colorado Saturday, it may throw moisture northwestward all the way towards us. But look what happens by March. It moves ever so slightly more north, but by April and May, it's going to be transiting the Pacific Northwest and the Central and Northern Rockies and Northern Plains more frequently. I'm cautiously optimistic, I guess is where I'm headed here, that we've seen the worst of El Nino's impacts on Montana. So it should play out colder, more stormy, does mean more opportunities for precipitation. We do have a big deficit, though. So I don't know if we're going to be able to make a comeback to where we can have above average snowpack and above average precipitation, but we don't see a pattern that's going to keep us sliding backwards, I guess, is what I'm saying. This is going to lead to colder weather, too. I would not be surprised if we have one more polar vortex late, mid to late February into early March. I think it's on the table. And if we have, that's actually a sign that the El Nino is going to continue to weaken and other things are going to be going on. So the Northwest drainages, I think, are going to be the hardest. Basically, the further north you are, there's going to be a gradient. Southern Montana is going to have the better precipitation chances as opposed to Northern Montana. I think there'll be a north-south gradient with precipitation. And if we were to take a look at the computer modeling, and I have to tell you, look at these with a grain of salt. All models are wrong. Some are useful. Okay, and so what I'm showing you is a useful tool to tell us maybe what the trend is. Anywhere you see green, the prediction is for above average precipitation. And this is for the 90-day period of February 1st through April 30th. Green is above average, brown's below, white is 50-50. Basically, you have a 50-50 chance of average precipitation. So what you want to do here is look at patterns. Now, does this make sense based on what we're seeing right now? The answer is yes, because it's showing the El Nino bringing more precipitation to California, parts of the Central Rockies and Southern Plains areas, but it is showing March and April and maybe late February, maybe getting more moisture into Montana. But it's also showing a deficit here in the mountains of Northwest Montana, but the plains might sort out better. Now, this is the European model, which tends to under forecast precipitation. And then we have the Canadian model. Now, don't get too excited. Now, if the Canadian model works out, great, right? Look at all that green all across Montana, getting into Alberta there and Saskatchewan and really getting even into the mountain areas. The Canadian model is a good model, but it tends to over forecast precipitation. So we have under forecast, over forecast. And then if we look at the climate forecast system, so I'm showing you what comes out of Canada and the European Center. Now, this is what your tax dollars give you. This is the climate forecast system that NOAA puts together. It's also showing February, March, and April precipitation to improve and get better. It also shows the El Nino pattern still going on across the South as well. So if we were to take the modeling at face value, that's encouraging, but it's modeling. And I've learned the hard way. Models are tools, they're not reality. But all three are hinting at a change of where we are now. That when you have modeling that agrees with historical precedent, which is what we've seen when we leave an El Nino and we go into a neutral phase, the models make sense. They don't contradict each other. So if you don't have that contradiction, then you're doing very well. So this transition from El Nino to neutral is good news. Usually what happens in a neutral status when you're going that way is you usually want to go with your 30-year averages, whether it's temperatures or precipitation. You're likely going to trend that way because the Pacific is not an El Nino. It's not a La Nina. It's gonna throw at you a variety of weather that's a little bit of both, but not be biased so strongly to one to the other. So as you just saw in the modeling, there is some hope that maybe the worst of the dryness is over. I don't see a drought signal either. If we were going to continue with a strong El Nino through spring and summer, I would definitely say drought, without a doubt. When we see strong El Ninos in the spring and early summer across the Northern Rockies and Northern Plains, Southwest Canada, that's a drought signal. And I don't see it. So with the El Nino weakening, that's good. Whether or not this new La Nina that's coming is going to be a big factor, we don't know yet. It's really hard to put really strong La Ninas like we had back to back or have them come up again. But this El Nino is definitely going away. It is not going to be a two-year El Nino whatsoever. The Pacific is going to go back to at least a cooler phase during that time frame. So I threw a lot at you. The good news is there's no test later. But now I'll open the floor to anybody that has any questions.
Yeah, I'll ask a question. So where does climate change figure into any of this? Is it a significant factor or what's your view on that?
Oh boy, you want to open a can of worms. What I showed you and what I talked about, I do not include any of that in there, and I'll tell you why. If you go into the literature, you have contradicting viewpoints on the impacts of climate change on La Nina and El Nino. There's not a strong signal. So what I have learned is that the Pacific trumps everything. So I'm more concerned about what the Pacific is doing, rather not what a fraction of the degree Celsius is going to have on global temperatures. And the thing to remember, too, is that the atmosphere and the oceans are coupled. So the atmosphere and the oceans are coupled. The air on top of the water is coupled with the air and the water are coupled, meaning that these changes in sea surface temperatures to warmer and colder, they're not driven by air temperature. It's the water that either heats or cools the air. It's not the air that heats or cools the water. So if you're going to have a slight change in air temperature and you see a big patch of warm water in the oceans, it's not because the Earth's warmer. It's that the oceans are warmer. The big question is why? And why does this happen? And we can know by doing sediment research that you can take sea cores and find that these alternating periods of warm, cold, and in the Pacific and drought in the West, they just line up. So the key to really understanding the Pacific is what drives these sea surface temperature changes. We don't know. We have some ideas, but they're not connected to methane or CO2 or nitrous oxide.
I guess I'll ask another one is how far out in predicting these are you feel comfortable? Would you feel comfortable saying what it's going to be a year from now?
No, I'm comfortable in the 5-day forecast. How's that? But all joking aside, the best we can do is try to hit the trends. And what I have learned and what I was taught by some very wise meteorologists when I was in college was if you really want to understand what's coming, you really need to be a student, a historic, you need to be a weather historian. Now, I showed you some graphs earlier when the Pacific was in cold phases going all the way back to the 1850s. And then when there were warm phases. Now, we can go back and we can reconstruct weather events in the Western United States during those. So that does, that historical perspective tends to outperform the modeling. So our the thing to remember about weather modeling is it starts with an initial data set that's real, that's measured. And then it takes that one measurement over a long period of time. And that's why weather forecasts have a lot of error as you go further in time, because you only have one set of data, because the forecast for Friday, this coming Friday, is based on weather data that was gathered today. And the forecast for Friday will be based on a forecast that was that is made for Thursday. It's a forecast built on a forecast. And so that is the problem with long-range modeling, is that you have to make some very rough assumptions. And then you got a lot of things that can pop up that you weren't expecting. So to answer your question, a year in advance, I can tell you we're probably going to be in a La Nina. What I can't tell you is, will it be strong enough to have a big impact on Montana or not? But I can tell you that if we're in a La Nina, a weak phase, that means 2025 is probably going to be close to your 30-year averages. You go with climatology in that situation. But in all honesty, the art of weather forecasting and long-range forecasting has got a long way to go, as you guys know. But we can try to hit the long-range trends. So I know a lot of you are concerned about drought, as well you should be, based on what's going on right now. From an historical weather historian perspective, when we go from an El Nino to a neutral phase, and even if we go into a weak La Nina by the middle to the end of summer, historically, that's not a drought signal for Montana. So I don't know if that helps, but the more you understand the past, the better the weather forecaster you are of the future.
Hi, I have a question. This is Hillary. How climate change and fossil fuel burning is contributing, because in part what I hear you saying is that the El Nino, La Nina ebb and flow is normal, and to understand what's happening in the what's going to happen in the future, we need to look to the past. But isn't part of this new conversation that things are no longer what we can, aren't we in a new phase in terms of what the climate is doing? And how does the burning of fossil fuels and the impact that humanity is having, how is that connected to the change in ocean temperatures, which is then affecting La Nina or El Nino, which is then affecting drought or lack of drought, and how, I'm just confused how it all is connected.
Yeah, and I completely understand the confusion. First of all, and I didn't expound on the literature. The literature is ambiguous in terms of whether or not climate change is changing La Nina and El Nino patterns. That's the science right now. So from that standpoint, we don't have anything that we can put our finger on and say that La Nina and El Nino patterns are going to be different. Now, I will tell you what is out there in the media. There is so much, I'll try to be nice here. There's so much in the media that just is not correct. And there's attributions made, especially with the oceans on climate change, that are just not correct. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and if you are up to date on the research, this does not show that. As I talked earlier, is that the oceans affect the atmosphere more than the atmosphere impacts the oceans. So if we have really warm ocean basins, which we do right now, the math doesn't work. If the Earth is 1 degree centigrade warmer, the amount of energy required of 1 degree Celsius to make the oceans warmer, you don't get a 1 Celsius increase in water temperature from a 1 increase in Celsius air temperature. I don't know if I'm helping you there or not, but if I guess the point is that a lot of the climate drivers in the Western United States are going to be overridden by the ocean interactions, not to say that climate change won't have an impact, but I don't have anything right now to tell you, oh, this is going to happen because of climate change. Or if we were to reduce CO2 emissions, would this mean more El Ninos or La Ninas? We don't know. And if anybody tells you they know, I don't believe them. It's just not in the literature.
But so are you saying climate change isn't real?
No, I'm not. What I'm saying is that if you want to look at climate change and the ocean interactions, it's too diffuse right now to be for sure. So you cannot make the categorical statement that the oceans are being impacted by climate change, especially the Pacific, and then be able to connect that to a weather forecast, which is what I do. So that doesn't mitigate it at all. But I really recommend that folks read the latest AR6 report from the UN Panel on Climate Change and go to their attribution section, where they try to make attributions between what they think human-induced changes in the weather and the climate are, and where they can connect the dots, and where they're able to say they think human interaction, burning the fossil fuels, causes this to happen. And if you go through that attribution list, what ends up happening is you don't see as many things there as you think, but they're there, okay? But it really behooves a lot of people to read that, because that really gives you the most recent science in terms of where we can make what we call attributions. So I'm trying not to mitigate it at all, but the question had to do with the oceans. Now, if you want to talk about land masses and continental weather, I think that's probably a bigger, a better argument. But in terms of impacting ocean basins, we don't have it yet. We don't have any seminal paper to prove it.
Okay, thank you very much.
This is Mickey Stewart. Could you talk to us a little bit about your forecast for temperatures, not just precipitation for the upcoming year, because it's the mix of the two that really affects us. So what's your thoughts on that?
Okay, good question. That's a really good question. So rule of thumb is this: higher soil moisture, which means if you have better late winter and spring precipitation as you hit the beginning of the summer season, you're going to have a cooler summer. This is why spring in this part of the country is so critical. You guys know what happens. If we don't have the March, April, May precipitation, you're not going to end up with a cool summer. You're going to end up with a hot, dry summer, because it's really critical that soil moisture that evaporates back into the air from spring precipitation really has a big impact on temperature during the summer season. That being said, if we end up across Montana with at or below normal precipitation, and I think that's probably going to be the case, although I think we're not going to be severely below normal with precipitation, but let's say we get back to average, or let's say we end up, to be conservative, let's say we end up with below average precipitation this spring by an inch and a half, 2 inches of rain and wet snow, that will lend itself to a warmer June, July, August, warmer than average. So the precipitation that falls between where we're standing right now and through early June is going to be really critical to how the summer goes. So watch that spring precipitation. And if it trends to closer to average, that means your temperatures this summer will probably be close to average. If we end up very dry, that's going to lead to a hotter, drier summer. Spring, if there's a strong correlation between spring precipitation and summer temperatures.
That's very useful. Thank you. It all goes back to the ocean temperature then, in a way, doesn't it?
Yep, we're ruled by the Pacific.
This Roger. If we, when we're looking at those drought monitor maps and they say extreme drought, or what are the increments in the color differences? When you go from, and then like if it's an extreme drought, is that so many inches less precipitation than normal? And then what is normal? Is that a 30-year average?
Okay, good questions. Yes, it is a 30-year average.
Okay.
And that's what they go with. And every 10 years it moves. So right now our 30-year average ends 2020. And the next 30-year average will be ending on 2030. So that is updated every 10 years like the census. I guess is a good way to describe it. Excuse me. So that drought monitor sometimes has a lag to it in terms of when they update these every Thursday, but it's actually based on precipitation that fell through Tuesday. So it's actually, even though they come out on Thursdays, it's precip through Tuesday. So you always have to keep that in mind. And they do put a lot of work into that, trying to get a good idea of moisture deficits across the U.S. And that comes from a variety of different sources, from volunteer observers to what's measured at airports and all of those things. But for snowpack as well, the snowtell data goes into those.
So no chance on those drought monitors, or no change?
Yes, correct. No change from the previous update.
Okay.
What I like to do, there is a map. If you go to the drought monitor, there's a drop-down window that will allow you to see the week-to-week changes, whether or not they're getting worse or better. And you can actually, they archive all those drought monitors. You can go and look at every drought monitor pretty far back. And that's something that I find is a very useful tool.
And that difference is based on the past 30 years, but actually only in the 10-year window. I'm a little confused there. You said 10, it's updated every 10 years, but it's based on the last 30.
Correct. What I meant by the 30 is they use a 30-year time period.
Okay.
That, yep. Every 10 years they move. So right now we're 1990 to 2020. The next one will be 2000 to 230.
Got it. Okay. In general, between extreme drought and no change, how much difference on average would you say that is in precipitation?
Not much, because once you get into extreme drought, you usually need a lot of precipitation to bust out of that.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And what you'll tend to see in severe drought situations, as I showed you with those earlier maps, is you tend to see the area of drought shrink on the edges until it goes to the middle. That's a very interesting trend that you'll see. You never want to be dead center of a drought because you're the last ones to get the benefit later.
you had a map that, or a graph that showed we've gone from El Ninos until about 95, I believe was, and now to La Ninas on average. Can you speak to one, why that happened? And do you expect that trend of La Ninas to continue on average to be more predominant than El Ninos?
Okay, that's a really good question. So let me go back and share screen here. Are you guys able to see it all there? Okay, so let me go to, okay, was this the graph you were referring to or the other one?
This one.
Okay, this one. Okay, yeah. So I didn't go too far into the Pacific Decadal Oscillation in terms of what we know about its length. What we do know about the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, which is you want to think about it in a 20 to 25 to 30 year cycle. So if you look, this, we had this big cycle change right here in 1998. Okay. So we've actually been 30 years plus of a colder Pacific than a warmer Pacific. If you go back historically and look at these right here, you can find some of these negative phases where it's colder, lasts as short as 15, some as lasts as far as 35 or 38, I think. The average time for the Pacific to go through these changes is usually 25 to 30 years plus or minus. So if we were to look at this, we're probably due for the Pacific to flip back to the warmer mode. But right now, from what we're seeing, at least for another year, it's going to stay in this colder phase. But it's really interesting how they found out the specific decadal oscillation. There was a graduate student at some university in the Pacific Northwest who was studying salmon, and they were studying where salmon are going to spawn every year, and they found a direct correlation between where the salmon go and where they don't go each year based on sea surface temperature, believe it or not. And they started to graph it, and they started to find this Pacific cycle. So we can thank salmon for understanding or trying to understand that the Pacific goes through these warmer and colder cycles. And the colder cycles are more droughty, without a doubt, than the warmer cycles. So we're overdue for the cycle to flip, but right now, at least for another year, that's not going to be the case.
Great, thanks.
Is our solar cycle, is that going to lessen the effect of like the upcoming El Niño or La Niña?
So solar cycles go 11 years. And what we do tend to see is that near solar maximums, when you have a lot of sunspot activity, that's where we are right now. There's a pretty strong correlation that solar cycles during their maximum, the maximum sunspot periods, you do tend to have an El Nino. And when you start to go to your solar minimums is when you have your stronger La Ninas. Now, interesting, if you go back and look at this graph right here, oh, let me go back here. Let me move this so I can see here better. So if you were to look at some of the stronger droughts, so 2010 and 11, 2021, okay, that's roughly 10 years of severe drought. And then you go back and you have severe drought 2010. Believe it or not, this may, you have to be careful about causation and correlation, okay? So I got to say that. You got to be really careful with this. But there does appear to be, and we can go back further in the record, and this does show up, that every 10 to 11 years during the solar minimum, you do get stronger La Ninas. And I will tell you the reason that may happen, this is getting into research that's very young and not agreed upon by everybody, so I have to say that. But there is some indication that during La Ninas, you have more clouds over the ocean basins, which make the oceans colder because of blocking the sun near the equator and other areas. And during El Ninos, you have less clouds, which make the ocean temperatures warmer. So there might be a connection to solar cycles, but it's not well accepted across the board yet, but it is very interesting. So the cycle we're in right now with the solar maximum and an El Nino does sync up. If I were to predict when the next severe El Nino is going to be just based on solar cycles, it would be 2030. But that's just going off of that, nothing else.
Okay, thanks. Really enjoy your podcast too.
Oh, good. Glad you like it.
I'm going to take the giant leap here based on what you said about soil moisture. And if it's dry in the spring, you're going to have a hot summer. And I know that grazing management isn't in your area necessarily, but would it be plausible to think that if we're having a dry spring, as people who are managing our grazing landscape, that we could, it would be really useful to be really careful to keep as good a litter layer as possible on the soil to help moderate the drying out of the soil moisture, so we could know maybe a little ahead of time if it's dry in March and April that we want to plan to be especially careful with our grazing to help maintain a litter layer to moderate the loss of soil moisture. Is that a giant leap, or does that kind of have an intuitive sense?
That's not a giant leap at all. And I'm trying to find here, I'm going to talk here while I do this. There was a really great rangeland management paper that came out of Colorado State University a few years ago. Now, it may or may not apply in Montana, but it does in Wyoming and Colorado. And I'm going to try to find it here. And if I can't find it, and even if I don't find it and I find it later, I'll send this off to Holly that she can share with everybody here. But it's a paper that examined sale weights from the 1940s to the, really, I think from the 1940s to around 2015, I think roughly. It's pretty interesting. They found strong correlation with sale weights and La Nina cycles. And what they did was they developed a decision tree for stocking based on that, which means if this is where you are in the La Nina El Nino cycle, these are the stocking recommendations. And I'll send that along. It's a very short paper, but it's the first range management piece of literature I've seen that makes the connection quite convincingly, at least in Wyoming and Colorado, to these cycles. It's very interesting. So the people who put that together, I think, are onto something. So to your point, yes, definitely what you were talking about, it would be certainly a good idea. And you know, I'll tell you this, if things don't turn around by mid to late March, I think that is certainly a sign that the forecast isn't going to go as I expect. If we start to ramp up here, as we get into February and into early to middle March, I think that'll continue into April and May.
That's all very interesting and gives us a lot of food for thought and also perhaps a species sense of control in that if we keep an eye on what our cumulative precip is for the year, we can be planning ahead for either faster movement of the livestock or herd reduction, which nobody likes to think about, but it is interesting because you are giving us a bit of a planning tool that's not like tomorrow. We could see what's happening in March and forecast how the temperatures to a certain extent in July, and that's very helpful.
Yeah, so that is, like I say, trend is your friend, and that's really all you can expect long-range forecasting is try to hit the trend correctly. But yeah, here it is. I found it right through here. So I'll send this along. But you can see right here, long-term forecast explains 70% of the differences in weight gain over 70-year experiment. So you're looking at a really good section of time there, 70 years of data that takes the weather and the sale weights and puts it together. So I'm hoping that there's further research with this in your part of the country as well. But I do think that maybe it may not be perfect for Montana because, as I said earlier, the signals aren't as strong. But I think it could be helpful in terms of how they went through this and how they suggest it. So you see this decision tree right here. So it talks about the Pacific decadal oscillation phase, whether or not you're in El Nino, La Nina, or neutral, and then it goes into stocking decisions. So I've been spreading this paper far and wide to people in Wyoming, Colorado, and Nebraska to at least take a serious look at this.
I have another question as it relates to like how severe storms are. Do you see any trends during drier weather or wetter weather about severity of thunderstorms and how it seems like it's really sporadic?
It is. It's very sporadic. And the up and downs with those changes in the Pacific are partly responsible for that. I will tell you this. First of all, I will tell you that I tend to see more severe extreme weather events during La Niñas in terms of whether it's wind. La Niñas, I mean, I live in Wyoming with the wind, right? La Niñas and wind are just awful. You get more wind, but you also tend to see more extremes in La Niñas really across all lower 48 states. You also tend, when it comes to severe weather in terms of, let's say, severe thunderstorms in the summer, I will tell you that in western Nebraska and eastern Colorado, eastern Wyoming, and northwest Kansas this summer, it was a tremendously wet spring. And so when we have really wet springs, your hail incidence goes up. And there's good reason for it, because you're putting more water in the air evaporating, and that does tend to make the thunderstorms a little more severe, a little more of an updraft, and then you tend to have more hail events. So all the benefits of a wet spring are great, except the hail. And that could be, that in eastern Montana in particular is something that, it's like you can't win for losing, right? Wet spring, and then you get hailed out. But that happened in many areas of Kansas, Colorado, and Nebraska this summer. There were dry beans that were planted three times in the panhandle of Nebraska this summer from the hail. And they had Scotts Bluff, Nebraska, they had over 23 inches of precipitation this year in 2023. They average about 16. And so that's where you can see that the severe weather can be impacted by things like that.
Anybody else have any questions? Thank you, Don. That was very insightful. Uplifting after coming
fingers,
in.
Fingers crossed.
Thinking that it was going to be a very dry year. So optimistic. I like it. So thank you very much for coming on. And I will get that to everybody, that publication. I will send that along. So
yeah, I'll send this right away. You guys had really good questions. Great questions. And keep asking questions and feel free to reach out if you have any more.